This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, February 25th, 2013. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, in Afghanistan, accounts of disappearances, torture, and killing of civilians prompts the government to call for the withdrawal of U.S. troops from one province. Protests spread across the West Bank after the death of a Palestinian prisoner in Israeli detention. And we'll go to Baton Rouge, Louisiana, where local residents call for justice as BP faces the opening day of a civil trial for the 2010 Gulf Coast oil disaster.
We have a Gulf that has changed. We feel it's been damaged. The people have been damaged. Our culture, our livelihood is hurt. And the folks need to be heard, and there needs to be justice.
Those stories and more coming up after this news.
I'm Nell Abram with FSRN Headlines. The president of the Philippines signed a law today that provides reparations to many who suffered abuse during the Ferdinand Marcos dictatorship. The signing comes on the 27th anniversary of the nonviolent People Power Revolution, which ended Marcos' 20-year rule. Madonna Varola has more.
Both survivors and lawmakers hailed the law that will compensate victims of human rights abuses under former President Ferdinand Marcos. During his rule, Marcos imposed military law, and at least 10,000 people were detained, tortured, raped, or disappeared. In addition to the compensation, the law provides for social and psychological assistance and mandates that martial law be taught in schools. The $244 million reparation dollars will come from about $600 million U.S. dollars the government recovered from Marcos' secret Swiss bank accounts. Marie Hilario Enriquez is chair of the Society of Ex-Detainees Against Detention and Arrest, or SELDA, which stood for Marcos's rights victims. She says the money is too little to leave a meaningful impact to victims who have waited as long as 40 years. Ferdinand Marcos died in 1989. His survivors continue to deny any wrongdoing by the family. His wife, 83-year-old Imelda, currently serves in Congress. His son is a senator. Madonna Virola, FSRN, Calapan City, Philippines.
About 100 U.S. troops are now on the ground in Niger, where they're establishing a drone base. Last month, the U.S. and Niger signed an agreement that gives troops stationed there legal immunity. According to a letter from President Barack Obama to Congress, the West African base will operate unarmed surveillance drones to aid the ongoing conflict in northern Mali. It's not clear if the drones will remain unarmed or if the U.S. military will also use the base for other aircraft. The U.S. also has forces in Ethiopia, Kenya, Somalia, and the island nation of the Seychelles, and deploys drones from Djibouti, where the unpiloted armed craft launch missions in Somalia and Yemen. At least 10 civilians were killed in the last 2 days of violence in Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. Hundreds of people have fled the violence, and humanitarian workers say it's increasingly difficult to deliver aid. Rival factions of rebel forces clashed near the Ugandan border. The fighting continues despite an accord signed Sunday by 11 African countries to end the conflict in the DRC. UN Radio's Derek Mbatha reports.
Leaders from the DR Congo, Mozambique, Rwanda, Uganda, Tanzania, South Africa, and South Sudan were present during the signing of the accord mediated by the United Nations. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon participated in the signing ceremony at the headquarters of the African Union in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. He stressed the importance of the commitment by the president of the DR Congo to implement all that is expected to be done by the government, including the reform of the security sector. Mr. Ban also underlined the shared responsibility of neighboring countries to help in the preservation and protection of the sovereignty, territorial integrity, as well as peace and stability of the Democratic Republic of the Congo. The eastern part of the DR Congo has been beset by fighting between the M23 armed rebels and government forces since April last year. The conflict has exacerbated the humanitarian situation in that part of the country, where it is estimated that over 2.4 million people have been displaced from their homes. Derek Mbata, United Nations.
In an updated legal settlement, a major U.S. energy company agreed today to close three coal-fired power plants and pay $8.5 million to downwind states. The power generated at the plants will be partially replaced by wind and solar energy. By 2015, American Electric Power will retire aging plants in Ohio, Kentucky, and Indiana, and install $5 billion in pollution controls at its eastern U.S. coal-fired plants. And by 2025, the energy giant says it will cut its sulfur dioxide emissions by nearly 80%. The suit was brought by 8 states where residents are affected by pollution emanating from power plants that drifts eastward over state lines. A new study by the U.S. government's National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration out yesterday says that if the Earth's temperature goes up 1.8 degrees, the productivity of the nation's laborers could go down as much as 10%. Labor output already slides to 90% during hot and humid months when workers are slowed by the heat. Using guidelines for labor standards in both the military and industrial sectors, study authors project that the amount of work accomplished by 2050 could drop to 80%. For FSRN from Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram.
I'm Dorian Marina in Los Angeles. The humanitarian crisis in Syria was a focus in Geneva today, where nations opened the 22nd session of the UN Human Rights Council. Navi Pillay, UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, said that so far, the UN's most powerful nations have not taken adequate action to stem the violence in Syria, where an estimated 70,000 people have been killed.
The Security Council has so far failed with regard to Syria, despite the repeated reports of widespread or systematic crimes and violations by my office, the International Commission of Inquiry on Syria, civil society organizations, and special procedures.
The President of the United Nations General Assembly, Serbian Vuk Jeremic, called Syria the most horrific humanitarian tragedy of our times.
There is a manifest danger that the violence will simply be allowed to run its course, a scenario that would continue to disproportionately affect the civilian population.
The UN says the violence is sending some 3,000 refugees across Syria's borders daily, many to nearby Jordan, where during 7 days last week, some 20,000 arrived. One of them was a woman named Intasar Gislan, who came with her young son.
My son dreams that I'm walking and that he's following me until he's either hit by a car or shelled by a bomb. He cries a lot, and we have to comfort him with the Quran.
Nearby Lebanon has also received an influx of refugees from Syria. Last month, the UN registered 38,000 refugees, the highest since the conflict began. Some gathered at a seaside refugee center in the north of the country, known as Harat al-Tanak, or Tin City, where refugees pieced together makeshift shelter using scrap metal, plastic, and tires. A woman named Fatima said her family still lacked basic supplies.
They gave us wood to build with, they gave us food vouchers, they gave us blankets to keep us warm, but not enough. It's because we're a large family. Still, it's better than nothing.
Today, Syria's foreign minister met with Russian officials in Moscow. He indicated that the government of Bashar al-Assad would be open to talks with opposition leaders, but the opposition criticized the comments, saying it had conditions that were not being met, such as the removal of Assad from power and the release of thousands who continue to be held at detention sites across the country. Clashes between Palestinian youth and Israeli troops erupted in the West Bank today as thousands marched in the funeral of Arafat Jaradat, who died Saturday in Israeli detention. The death comes as a growing number of Palestinian prisoners have been joining hunger strikes to protest ill treatment and the lack of due process. FSRN's Ghassan Benora reports.
Chanting "God is great" and waving Palestinian flags, thousands gathered in the town of Sa'ir in southern West Bank to participate in the funeral for Arafat Jaradat. Local political leaders from Fatah, Hamas, and other political groups promised in their speeches that their groups will retaliate for Jaradat's death. Leaders also threatened to abduct Israeli soldiers to exchange them for Palestinian political prisoners held by Israel. A week ago, Israeli troops went to Jaradat's home and arrested him on suspicion of throwing rocks during a protest of illegal Israeli settlements and of being a member of the Palestinian president's Fatah party. His lawyer last saw him on Thursday when Jaradat appeared before a military judge and complained of long interrogations and back pain. After his death, the Israeli army said it was due to cardiac arrest. According to his family, Jaradat did not suffer from any heart illness. The autopsy confirmed he did not die of heart failure, but doesn't list a cause of death. A Palestinian doctor attending the autopsy said Jaradat's body showed signs of torture. Majdi Al-Adra is spokesperson for the Palestinian Ministry for Political Prisoners Affairs.
The member of the medical autopsy sent by our minister, Dr. Saber Al-Alu, concluded in his report that Arafat's heart did not suffer from cardiac arrest, and he has also said that there are marks of torture on his neck and his left shoulder, and that his second and third left ribs are broken and there are severe marks on his left side of his abdomen, and a contusion on his back that goes 9 centimeters inwards.
The Palestinian Ministry for Political Prisoners Affairs was very critical of the Israeli autopsy. Isa Karakeh, Political Prisoners Affairs Minister, questioned why Israeli doctors were unable to see signs of torture on Jaradat's body. About 500 Palestinian detainees inside the Megiddo Detention Center started a 3-day hunger strike in protest of Jaradat's death. Another 7 prisoners announced they would begin a long-term hunger strike. So far, the longest hunger strike has been by detainee Samer Isawi, who's been refusing food for an estimated 220 days. It is not clear how he managed to survive this long. Murad Jadallah is from Ad-Damir Association for Prisoner Support and Human Rights.
The protests by the political detainees against this crime are likely to escalate because this year we have witnessed the death of 2 political prisoners, one in January, and in February we lost Arafat Jaradat. This raises the death toll of the political detainees to 203 martyrs.
In January of this year, Ashraf Abu Dhraa died due to deteriorating health conditions just 3 days after the Israeli army released him. Ad-Damir and other human rights groups are demanding intervention from the United Nations and the European Union to protect the human rights of 4,500 Palestinians currently being held by Israel. Ghassan Bannoura, FSRN, Bethlehem.
Afghanistan's National Security Council is demanding that all foreign special ops forces leave the key province of Wardak within 2 weeks, citing reports that American soldiers engaged in torture and extrajudicial killings. NATO leaders denied the allegations at a press conference today, but some veterans' rights groups and progressive lawmakers are petitioning the Obama administration to quickly pull the U.S. military out of the province and the entire country. In Washington, D.C., FSRN's Alice Olstein has more.
President Karzai released a statement Sunday saying that armed individuals named as U.S. Special Forces have been, quote, harassing, annoying, torturing, and even murdering innocent people in the Maiden Wardak province. He tapped the Ministry of Defense to make sure all U.S. Special Forces are out of the province within 2 weeks, saying that the behavior of the troops has, quote, caused local public resentment and hatred. In a press conference Monday morning, NATO spokesperson Günter Katz denied the charges.
We take all allegations of misconduct seriously and go to great lengths to determine the facts surrounding them. Over the past few weeks, there have been various allegations of special forces conducting themselves in an unprofessional manner in Maiden Wardak. So far, we could not find evidence that would support these allegations.
Katz did not promise to pull troops out of the area, saying instead that NATO would negotiate with the Afghan government going forward. The Afghan National Security Council's resolution detailed a few examples of the alleged pattern of abuse in the rural farming province. In one incident, a quote, suspicious force disappeared 9 civilians. In another, a young student was abducted from his home at night. His body was found 2 days later under a bridge with signs of torture and his throat slit. Afghanistan veteran Nicholas O'Neill, who served in the infantry for 1 year in 2007, said whether or not these allegations are true, the Afghan government's response shows growing discontent with the abuses of the U.S. military's occupation, from the burning of Qurans to airstrikes that have killed children.
Nobody can contest that countless thousands of innocent civilians have been killed by NATO and Afghan forces in this war's 11 years. Nobody contests that U.S. forces have abducted Afghans through extraordinary rendition over the course of that time.
Many of these crimes are known to the public because of the Afghan war logs that Private First Class Bradley Manning allegedly passed to WikiLeaks for international release. Afghanistan veteran Jacob David George, who served 3 tours in the U.S. Special Forces, says he hopes more whistleblowers come forward.
We do have some evidence of what it actually looks like on the ground, and that terrible things like this do happen. Now, does that mean that U.S. Special Forces did this incident in particular? Who knows? Unfortunately, we may never know that unless another brave soldier steps up and releases those reports.
George returned to Afghanistan in 2011 as a civilian to conduct interviews, and said Afghan people primarily expressed anger about indiscriminate drone strikes and night raids. But O'Neill, now an activist with Veterans for Peace, says it's not only major scandals and abuses that create anti-American sentiment, but the daily grind of living under occupation.
If we think of ourselves as Americans, if we had to take our kids to the doctor, but were stopped because a convoy wanted to do a security check on the way and had to wait for hours, we would be very upset. If every morning as we rushed out the door to go to work to try to make it on time, we didn't know whether we'd be stopped, pulled out of our car, and searched up against the wall in front of our family, we would become very discontent with whatever foreign presence was causing that to happen.
O'Neill says he wants the U.S. to withdraw all military from the country and redirect the billions in aid currently being spent on security and weapons to things like irrigation and education. Some lawmakers in Congress agree and are trying to pass legislation to repeal the original bill authorizing the war and bring about a complete end to the U.S. military presence. California Democrat Barbara Lee reintroduced her Responsible End to the War in Afghanistan Act in January, which would defund all military operations except the withdrawal of troops. But the bill has yet to be taken up by the Republican-controlled Armed Services Committee. Alice Olstein, FSRN, Washington.
Bradley Manning, the Army private who is facing military charges for his alleged leaking of classified documents to WikiLeaks, has now been in detention for more than 1,000 days. During much of that time, he was held in solitary confinement and faced other restrictions. Saturday, February 23rd, marked the 1,000th day of Manning's detention, and rallies were held around the country to call for his release. Nearly 100 supporters gathered at Park Street Station in downtown Boston for a rally and speak out. FSRN's Chuck Racina was there and brings you their voices.
Free Bradley Manning!
Free Bradley Manning! Free Bradley Manning!
The only thing that Bradley Manning has done is to tell the American people the truth about our wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and we do not consider that a crime. It's not a crime to expose war crimes. We think the people who did those war crimes are the ones who should be in jail, not Bradley Manning.
So the point is that we have to begin a campaign, and we've been doing it the last several months, starting back in the summer, to call on the President of the United States, who has the authority to do so under Article 2, Section 2 of the U.S. Constitution, to pardon Bradley Manning. Now, he could do it today. Now, the reality is no, it's not going to happen. But he can do it on his own authority as the President of the United States.
Hi, my name is Justin Diodario. I'll make this short and sweet. I was in the U.S. Army for 3 years and 4 months. I served in Iraq and Afghanistan. I am telling you right now, Bradley Manning speaks the truth. Things happen over there that just, it's not like a war zone at all. It's more of a police state. My job over there was to look for IEDs. We'll look for roadside bombs. They told us always have your eyes open. Always be on the lookout for things that might hurt you. I feel like I was the only one over there that really had my eyes open. Because everybody else says, oh, we're over there to, you know, to fight for our freedoms. But the people taking away our freedoms are not the ones over there. They're the ones right here. Free Bradley Manning.
You know, it's my obligation as a veteran. I sworn to uphold the Constitution from all enemies, foreign and domestic. As far as I'm concerned, the people keeping Bradley Manning in jail are a domestic enemy. But I'm saying this stuff. I know what I saw over there. I know what happened over there.
The whole war wouldn't have even happened if we had had access to real information. Lying is how all this stuff is happening, and the government's interest in sustaining their lies by persecuting people who tell the truth is what's at heart, not only in trying to accuse Julian Assange of treason, but also of Aaron Swartz, who killed himself. And I'm really glad to see the Pirate Party here because the Pirate Party, I actually joined the Pirate Party, and I'm not into computers at all. I joined because they stand for our right to access to information and knowledge. Anyway, Bradley Manning haunts me. It really bothers me that we're all walking around while this guy is being tormented in prison, isolated.
He's like the Daniel Ellsberg of our time, and he certainly let us know information that we need to know about the conduct of the war in Iraq.
And so we've got to stand behind Bradley Manning because he stood up for the truth, and this is the 1,000th day that he's been in jail now with no trial, and his trial won't be until June, but we certainly hope that they don't put him away for life like they're trying to.
Free Bradley Manning!
Free Bradley Manning! Free Bradley Manning! Free Bradley Manning!
Those are the voices of Susan McLucas, Al Johnson, Justin Deodorita, Lydia Eccles, and Dale Soak speaking at Boston's Park Street Station on Saturday to mark the 1,000th day of Bradley Manning's detention. The civil trial for the BP oil disaster began today at a federal district court in New Orleans, even as reports of a possible settlement continued to come out. The trial is set to focus on the causes of the 2010 accident and explosion at the Macondo oil rig that killed 11 workers and led to a massive oil disaster across the Gulf Coast. The case will look at whether BP can be held accountable for gross negligence, a determination that could vastly increase the fines under the Clean Water Act. For more, we're joined by Mary Lee Orr. She's executive director with the Louisiana Environmental Action Network and the Lower Mississippi River Keeper. She's speaking to us from Baton Rouge. Welcome to FSRN.
Thank you for having me.
It's been nearly 3 years since April 2010 and when the disaster began. How are the communities you work with faring today?
I just was at a conference with many of the people who've been affected, and to be honest, they are exhausted. This has been mentally, physically, and spiritually exhausting for the communities. They're very concerned about losing their culture, their way of life. And as you know, this has been dragging on and on and on, hence the trial, the importance of the trial that starts today. But the communities themselves are, even though we're a very resilient, a very tough area, because we have lots of hurricanes and disasters that have come through before, and we rebuild. The BP disaster has been something that I've noticed has been the hardest of all for people to bounce back from.
And just before we got on the line to speak, you were in that conference speaking with local groups. What are some things they're telling you about the impact on their communities?
They're talking about the economic impact, the loss of catch. There isn't as much seafood out there for them to get. It's difficult for them to sell it because people are concerned about the safety of the seafood. People are talking about illnesses, rashes, respiratory problems, you name it, that they believe is correlated with some of them who worked on the VU boats. A lot of our fishermen, of course, went out to save their beloved Gulf, so they're finding that they're having continuing health problems. So it's very sobering.
The first part of the trial, which does begin today, is to focus on who exactly is responsible for the accident that triggered the spill. What are you looking for in this week's trial?
I think that I would speak for everyone in saying that we're looking for justice. So far, the settlement hasn't been adequate and hasn't fully addressed the suffering of the fishermen and the communities. And something I'd like your listeners to know or think about is that the Gulf of Mexico is the ninth largest body of water in the world, one of the world's most complex ecosystems, and the U.S. biggest supplier of seafood. So this is a really important area to our country, to the nation, to the global nation, and to see it like this is very, very painful. But I'm hoping that this is a first step towards justice for people. They've been wanting this. In fact, we were part of a coalition that sent in 47 groups, organizations that sent a letter to all the federal, state officials, et cetera, saying that we really wanted a trial, that it would take a trial to have the truth come out.
Well, you talk about the importance of having a trial for residents and for groups that you're working with. There are reports of a possible settlement. According to the New York Times, it could limit fines that BP pays under the Clean Water Act. What is your view of a settlement at this point?
I'm concerned when I hear the word settlement because that hasn't been adequate for the last 3 years. And BP has a long history of criminal offenses concerning both environmental pollution and worker safety. So this isn't a company that has a very good record. And as you know, they've already been convicted on several counts. So we feel that it's very important to move forward with the trial. I'm hoping, I really believe that's the only way the truth will come out. And I guess time will tell. Some people think if the trial starts, what, there'll be 3 months, and then there's other steps that we have to go through. And for many people, this has been a long time coming. They've been wanting it, so they're celebrating the fact that the truth will come out and people will really understand, because I think this has moved away from the consciousness of a lot of people in the other parts of the country, while those of us down here have still been suffering the effects. And I talk about the people, but we can't forget, Dorian, the wildlife, the dolphins, the stillbirths of the dolphins, the dead, you know, ocean creatures. I mean, it's been unbelievable and very disturbing to see a lot of what I get, a lot of photos that people send to me from all along the Gulf, not just Louisiana, but things are not the way they used to be in the Gulf of Mexico.
And are you still seeing that now?
Yes. And it's not just myself. You can look it up. The scientists are disturbed because there was a certain rate of stillborn dolphins during a certain amount of time, and now this has increased so much dramatically. And certainly our fishermen have talked about it, that caused them a lot of concern. There was a large meeting during the summer that our staff attended, the Lower Mississippi River Keeper and Michael, and they asked the room of maybe 600 fishermen how many people were seeing abnormalities in their catch. Every fisherman in that room raised their hand.
Mm.
So that's sobering news, very sobering news. But we still remain hopeful about the resilience of the Gulf, but we also believe that there needs to be justice about what's happened to us. It's not our fault. It's not the people's fault. And the people who depend on this, all of us, I mean, it's a way of life for us here, right? And the folks who get the seafood in other parts of the country deserve justice, I believe.
Mary Lee Orr is Executive Director of the Louisiana Environmental Action Network. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you so much, and I look forward to sharing with you in the future.
That's it for today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Comp. Headlines editor was Nell Abram. Our Washington, D.C. editor, Alice Olstein. Our technical production team at KPFA Berkeley is Rose Katapchi and Janine Etter. Our theme music was composed and produced for FSRN by Alan Weatherhead. We welcome your questions, comments, and news tips. Write to us, comments@fsrn.org. For more news stories, specials, and our documentaries, visit our website, fsrn.org, and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/fsrn. Thanks for listening. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina.